The weather had turned cold, and the sullen afternoon sky was spitting pellets of hard frozen snow. 100 cloaked and black-armored Pandian knights rode at a jingling trot through the heavily forested region near the Arcian border, with Sparhawk and Sophronia in the lead. They had been traveling for 5 days. Sparhawk glanced up at the sky and reined in the black horse he was riding. The horse reared, pawing at the air with his front hooves. "Oh, stop that," Sparhawk told him irritably.
"He's very enthusiastic, isn't he?" Sophronia said.
"He's also not very bright. I'll be glad when we catch up with Calton and I can get Farron back."
"Why are we stopping?"
"It's close to evening, and that grove over there seems to be fairly clear of undergrowth. We may as well set up our night's encampment here." He raised his voice then, calling back over his shoulder. "Sir Parasim!" he shouted. The young knight with the butter-colored hair rode forward.
"Yes, my lord Sparhawk," he said in his light, tenor voice.
"We'll stop for the night here," Sparhawk told him. "As soon as the wagons get here, set up Sophronia's tent for her, and see to it that she has everything she needs."
"Of course, my lord."
The sky had turned a chill purple by the time Sparhawk had overseen the setting up of their encampment and had posted sentries. He walked past the tents and the flickering cooking fires to join Sophronia at the small fire before her tent, which was set slightly apart from the rest of the camp. He smiled when he saw her ever-present tea kettle hanging from a metal tripod which he had set over the flames.
"Something amusing, Sparhawk?" she asked.
"No," he said, "not really." He looked back toward the youthful knights, moving around their cooking fires. "They all seem so young," he said, almost as if to himself. "Hardly more than boys."
"That's the nature of things, Sparhawk. The old make the decisions, and the young carry them out."
"Was I ever that young?" she laughed. "Oh yes, dear Sparhawk," she told him.
"You couldn't begin to believe how young you and Calton were when you came to me for your first lessons. I felt as if a pair of babies had been placed in my care."
He made a rueful face. "I guess that answers that question, doesn't it?" He held out his hands to the warmth of her fire. "It's a cold night. I think my blood thinned out while I was in Jurok. I haven't been really warm since I came back to Elenia. Did Parasim bring you your supper?"
"Yes. He's a very nice boy, isn't he?"
Sparhawk laughed. "He'd probably be offended if he heard you say that."
"It's the truth, isn't it?"
"Of course, but he'd be offended all the same. Young knights are always sensitive."
"Have you ever heard him sing?"
"Once, in chapel."
"He has a glorious voice, doesn't he?"
Sparhawk nodded. "I don't think he really belongs in a militant order. A regular monastery would probably suit his temperament better." He looked around, then stepped outside the circle of firelight, dragged a log to the side of the fire, and covered it with his cloak. "It's not exactly an easy chair," he apologized, "but it's better than sitting on the ground."
"Thank you, Sparhawk," she smiled. "That was very thoughtful of you."
"I do have a few manners, I suppose." He looked at her gravely.
"This is going to be a hard journey for you, I'm afraid." "I can endure it, my dear."
"Perhaps, but don't go out of your way to be unnecessarily brave. If you get tired or cold, don't hesitate to say something to me."
"I'll be just fine, Sparhawk. Styrix are a hardy people."
"Sophronia," he said then, "how long will it be until the 12 knights who are in the throne room with you begin to die?"
"That's really impossible to say, Sparhawk. Will you know, each time it happens, I mean?" "Yes. At the moment, I'm the one to whom their swords will be delivered."
"Their swords?"
"The swords were the instruments of the spell, and they symbolize the burden that must be passed on."
Wouldn't it have been wiser to have distributed that responsibility?
I chose not to.
That might have been a mistake.
Perhaps, but it was mine to make.
He began to pace angrily. We should be working on a cure instead of riding halfway across Arcium, he burst out.
This is important too, Sparhawk. I couldn't bear to lose you, and Alana, he said, and Vanyan too. There's still time, dear one, he sighed.
Are you all settled in then? He asked her.
Yes, I have everything I need.
Try to get a good night's sleep. We'll be starting early.
Good night, Sophronia. Sleep well, Sparhawk.
He awoke as daybreak had begun to spread its light through the wood. He strapped on his armor, shivering at the touch of the cold plate. He emerged from the tent he shared with five other knights and looked around the sleeping camp. Sophrenia's fire was flickering in front of her tent again, and her white robe gleamed in the steely light of dawn and the glow of her fire. You're up early, he said as he approached her.
So are you. How far is it to the border?
We should cross into Arcium today.
And then, from somewhere out in the forest, they heard a strange, flute-like sound.
The melody was in a minor key, but it was not sad. Rather, it seemed filled with an ageless joy. Sophrenia's eyes grew wide, and she made a peculiar gesture with her right hand. A shepherd, maybe? Sparhawk said.
No, she replied. Not a shepherd.
She stood up.
Come with me, Sparhawk,
she said, and then she led him away from the fire. The sky was growing lighter as they moved out into the meadow lying just to the south of their encampment, following the flute-like sound. They approached the sentry Sparhawk had stationed there.
You heard it too, my lord Sparhawk, the black-armored knight asked.
Yes, can you see who it is or where it's coming from?
I can't make out who it is yet, but it seems to be coming from that tree out in the center of the meadow. Do you want me to come along with you?
No, stay here. We'll investigate. Sophrenia had already gone on ahead, moving directly toward the tree that seemed to be the source of the strange melody. You'd better let me go first, Sparhawk said when he caught up with her.
There's no danger, Sparhawk.
When they reached the tree, Sparhawk peered up through the shadowy limbs and saw the mysterious musician. It was a little girl of six or so. Her long hair was black and glossy, and her large eyes were as deep as night. A headband of plaited grass encircled her brow, holding her hair back. She was sitting on a limb, breathing sound into a simple, many-chambered set of pipes, such as a goat herd might play. Although it was quite cold, she wore only a short, belted linen smock that left her arms and legs bare. Her grass-stained, unshod feet were crossed, and she perched on the limb with a sedate sureness.
What's she doing here? Sparhawk asked, puzzled. There aren't any houses or villages around.
I think she's been waiting for us, Sophrenia replied.
That doesn't make any sense. He looked up at the child. What's your name, little girl? He asked.
Let me question her, Sparhawk,
Sophrenia said.
She's a steric child, and they tend to be shy.
She pushed back her hood and spoke to the little girl in a dialect Sparhawk did not understand. The child lowered her rude pipe and smiled. Her lips were like a small, pink bow. Sophrenia asked her another question in a strange, gentle tone. The little girl shook her head. Does she live in some house back in the forest? Sparhawk asked.
She has no home nearby, Sophrenia said.
Doesn't she talk?
She chooses not to.
Sparhawk looked around. Well, we can't leave her here. He reached up his arms to the child. Come down, little girl, he said. She smiled at him and slipped off the limb into his hands. Her weight was very slight, and her hair smelled of grass and trees. She confidently put her arms about his neck and then wrinkled her nose at the smell of his armor. He set her down on her feet, and she immediately went to Sophronia, took the small woman's hands in hers, and kissed them. Something peculiarly styric seemed to pass between the woman and the little girl, something that Sparhawk could not understand. Sophronia lifted the child into her arms and held her close.
"What will we do with her, Sparhawk?"
she asked in a strangely intent tone. For some reason, it seemed very important to her.
"We'll have to take her with us, I guess, at least until we find some people to leave her with. Let's go back to camp and see if we can find something for her to wear.
And some breakfast, I think.
Would you like that flute?" Sparhawk asked the child. The little girl smiled and nodded.
"Why did you call her that?"
Sophronia asked him.
"We have to call her something, at least until we find out her real name, if she has one. Let's go back to the fire where it's warm."
He turned and led the way back across the meadow towards the camp. They crossed the border into Arcium near the city of Deros, once again avoiding contact with the local inhabitants. They paralleled the road leading eastward, staying well back from that heavily traveled highway. The countryside of the kingdom of Arcium was noticeably different from that of Illenia. Unlike its northern neighbor, Arcium seemed to be a kingdom of walls. They stretched along the roads or cut across open pasture land, often for no apparent reason. The walls were thick and high, and Sparhawk was frequently obliged to lead his knights on long detours to go around them. Wryly, he remembered the words of a 24th century patriarch of the church who, after traveling from Krellos to Larium, had referred to Arcium as God's rock garden. The following day, they entered a large forest of winter-bare birch trees. As they rode deeper into the chill wood, Sparhawk began to smell smoke, and he soon saw a dark pall lying low among the stark white tree trunks. He halted the column and rode on ahead to investigate. He had gone perhaps a mile when he came to a cluster of rudely built styric houses. They were all on fire, and bodies littered the open area around the houses. Sparhawk began to swear. He wheeled the young black horse round and galloped back to where he had left his troops.
"What is it?"
Sophronia asked him, looking at his bleak expression.
"Where's the smoke coming from?"
"There was a styric village up ahead," he replied darkly. "We both know what the smoke means."
"Ah,"
she sighed. "You'd better keep the little girl back here until I can get a burial detail up there."
"No, Sparhawk. This sort of thing is part of her heritage, too. All Styrics know that it happens. Besides, I might be able to help the survivors, if there are any."
"Have it your own way," he said shortly. A huge rage had descended upon him, and he curtly motioned the column forward. There was some evidence that the hapless Styrics had made an attempt to defend themselves, but that they had been swarmed over by people carrying only the crudest of weapons. Sparhawk put his men to work, some of them digging graves and others extinguishing the fires. Sophronia came across the littered field, her face deathly pale.
"There are only a few women among the dead," she reported. "I'd guessed that the rest fled back into the woods."
"See if you can persuade them to come back," he said. He looked over at Sir Parasim, who was weeping openly as he spaded dirt out of a grave. The young knight was obviously not emotionally suited for this kind of work. "Parasim," Sparhawk ordered, "go with Sophronia."
"Yes, my lord."
Parasim sobbed, dropping his spade. The dead were finally all committed to the earth, and Sparhawk briefly murmured an Aline prayer over the graves. It was probably not appropriate for Styrics, but he didn't really know what else to do. After about an hour, Sophronia and Parasim returned. "Any luck?" Sparhawk asked her.
"We found them," she replied, "but they won't come out of the woods."
"I can't really blame them very much," he said. "We'll see if we can fix up at least a few of these houses for them to keep them out of the weather.
Don't waste your time, Sparhawk. They won't come back to this place. That's part of the Styric religion.
Did they give you some idea of which way the Alleans who did this went?
What are you planning, Sparhawk?
Chastisement. That's a part of the Allene religion.
No, I won't tell you which way they went, if that's what you've got in mind.
I'm not going to let this pass, Afrenia. You can tell me or not. Whichever you choose. I can find their trail by myself if I need to.
She looked at him helplessly. Then her eyes became shrewd.
A bargain, Sparhawk?
She suggested. I'll listen.
I'll tell you where to find them, if you promise not to kill anybody.
All right, he agreed grudgingly, his face still black with anger. Which way did they go?
I'm not done yet, she said. You'll stay here with me. I know you, and you sometimes go to extremes. Send someone else to do it.
He glared at her, then turned. Lachis, he bellowed.
No, she said. Not Lachis. He's as bad as you are.
Who, then?
Perisim, I think.
Perisim?
He's a gentle person. If we tell him not to kill anybody, he won't make any mistakes.
All right, then, he said from between clenched teeth. Perisim, he said to the young knight, standing sorrowfully nearby. Take a dozen men and run down the animals who did this. Don't kill anybody, but make them all very, very sorry that they ever came up with the idea.
Yes, my lord,
Perisim said, his eyes suddenly glinting like steel. Sophronia gave him directions, and he started back to where the other knights were gathered. On his way, he stopped and uprooted a thorn bush. He seized it in one gauntleted fist, and swung it very hard at an unoffending birch tree, ripping off a fair-sized chunk of white bark.
Oh dear,
Sophronia murmured.
He'll do just fine, Sparhawk laughed mirthlessly. I have great hopes for that young man, and great faith in his sense of the appropriate. Some distance away, Flute was standing over the scattered graves. She was playing her pipe softly, and her melody seemed to convey eons of sorrow.
The weather continued cold and unpleasant, though no significant amounts of snow fell. After a week of steady travel, they reached a ruined castle some 6 or 8 leagues west of the city of Dara. Calton and the main body of the Pandian knights awaited them there.
I thought you'd got lost, the blonde man said, as he reined up in front of Sparhawk. He looked curiously at Flute, who sat in front of Sparhawk's saddle, her bare feet both on one side of the black horse's neck and with Sparhawk's cloak wrapped around her.
Isn't it a little late for you to be starting a family?
We found her along the way, Sparhawk replied. He took the little girl and handed her across to Sophronia.
Why didn't you put some shoes on her?
We did. She keeps losing them. There's a nunnery on the other side of Dara. We'll drop her off there.
Sparhawk looked at the ruin crouched on the hill above them.
Is there any kind of shelter in there?
Some. It breaks the wind, at least.
Let's get inside, then. Did Curic bring Farron in my armor?
Calton nodded.
Good. This horse is a little unruly, and Vanyan's old armor has rubbed me raw in more places than I care to count.
They rode up into the ruin and found Curic and the young novice Barrett waiting for them.
What took you so long? Curic asked bluntly.
It's a long way, Curic, Sparhawk replied a bit defensively, and the wagons can only move so fast.
You should have left them behind.
They were carrying the food and extra equipment.
Curic grunted. Let's get in out of the weather. I've got a fire going in what's left of that watchtower over there.
He looked rather peculiarly at Sophronia, who carried Flute in her arms.
Lady, he greeted her respectfully.
Dear Curic, she said warmly, how are Aslaid and the boys?
Well, Sophronia, he replied, very well indeed.
I'm so glad to hear it.
Calton said you'd be coming along, he said to her. I have water boiling for your tea.
He looked at Flute, who had her face nestled against Sophronia's.
"Have you been keeping secrets from us?"
She laughed, a rippling cascade of a laugh.
"That's what Styrix do best, Kyrick.
Let's get you all inside where it's warm."
He turned and led the way across the rubble-strewn courtyard of the ruin, leaving Barret to care for the horses.
"Was it a good idea to bring him along?" Sparhawk asked, jerking his thumb back over his shoulder in the direction of the novice. "He's a little young for an all-out battle."
"He'll be all right, Sparhawk," Kyrick said. "I took him to the practice field at Deimos a few times and gave him some instruction. He handles himself well, and he learns fast."
"All right, Kyrick," Sparhawk said, "but when the fighting starts, stay close to him. I don't want him getting hurt."
"I never let you get hurt, did I?"
Sparhawk grinned at his friend. "No, as I recall, you didn't." They stayed the night in the ruin and rode out early the following morning. Their combined forces numbered just over 500 men, and they rode south under a still threatening sky. Just beyond Dara stood a nunnery with yellow sandstone walls and a red tile roof. Sparhawk and Sophronia turned aside from the road and crossed a winter-browned meadow toward the building.
"And what is the child's name?"
the black-robed Mother Superior asked when they were admitted into her presence in a severely simple room with only a small brazier to warm it.
"She doesn't talk, Mother," Sparhawk replied. "She plays those pipes all the time, so we call her Flute."
"That is an unseemly name, my son." "The child doesn't mind, Mother Superior," Sophronia told her. "Did you make some effort to find her parents?"
"There was no one in the vicinity when we found her," Sparhawk explained. The Mother Superior looked gravely at Sophronia.
"The child is Styrick," she pointed out. "Would it not perhaps be better to put her with a family of her own race and her own faith?" "We have pressing business," Sophronia said, "and Styrix can be very difficult to find when they choose to be. You know, of course, that if she stays with us, we will raise her in the Aline faith."
Sophronia smiled.
"You will try, Mother Superior. I think you will find that she's not amenable to conversion, however. Coming, Sparhawk?"
They rejoined the column and rode south under clearing skies, moving first at a rolling trot and then at a thunderous gallop. They crossed a knoll, and Sparhawk reined Farron in sharply, staring in astonishment at Flute, who sat cross-legged on a large white rock, playing her pipes.
"How did you—"
he began, then broke off. "Sophronia!" he called. But the white-robed woman had already dismounted. She approached the child, speaking gently to her in that strange Styrick dialect. Flute lowered her pipes and gave Sparhawk an impish little grin. Sophronia laughed and took the child in her arms.
"How did she get ahead of us?" Calton asked, his face baffled.
"Who knows?" Sparhawk replied. "I guess I'd better take her back."
"No, Sparhawk," Sophronia said firmly. "She wants to go with us."
"That's too bad," he said bluntly. "I'm not going to take a little girl into battle."
"Don't concern yourself with her, Sparhawk. I'll care for her."
She smiled at the child nestled in her arms.
"I'll care for her as if she were my own."
She laid her cheek against Flute's glossy black hair.
"In a way, she is."
He gave up.
"Have it your own way," he said.
Just as he began to wheel Farron around, he felt a sudden chill, accompanied by the sense of an implacable hatred.
"Sophronia!" he said sharply.
"I felt it too!"
she cried, drawing the little girl closer to her.
"It's directed at the child!"
Flute struggled briefly, and Sophronia, looking surprised, set her down. The little girl's face was set, looking more annoyed than angered or frightened. She set her pipes to her lips and began to play. The melody this time was not that light air in a minor key which she had played before. It was sterner and peculiarly ominous. Then, from some distance away,
they heard a sudden howl of pain and surprise. The howl immediately began to fade, as if whoever or whatever had made it were fleeing at an unimaginable rate.
"What was that?" Kalthan exclaimed.
"An unfriendly spirit," Sophronia replied calmly.
"What drove it away?"
"The child's song. It seems that she has learned to protect herself."
"Do you understand any of what's going on here?" Kalthan asked Sparhawk.
"No more than you do. Let's keep moving. We've still got a couple of days of hard riding ahead of us."
The castle of Count Randoon, the uncle of King Dragos, was perched atop a high, rocky promontory. Like so many of the castles in this southern kingdom, it was surrounded by massive walls. The weather had cleared off, and the noonday sun was very bright as Sparhawk, Kalthan, and Sophronia, who still carried flute in front of her saddle, rode across a broad meadow of yellow grass towards the fortress. They were admitted without question. In the courtyard, they were met by the Count, a blocky man with heavy shoulders and silver-shot hair. He wore a dark green doublet trimmed in black and surmounted by a heavily starched white ruff of a collar. It was a style which had gone out of fashion in Alenia decades ago.
"My house is honored to welcome the Knights of the Church," he declared formally after they had introduced themselves.
Sparhawk swung down off Farron's back. "Your hospitality is legendary, my lord," he said, "but our visit is not entirely social. Is there some place private where we can talk? We have a matter of some urgency to discuss with you."
"Of course," the Count replied. "If you will all be so good as to come with me."
They followed him through the broad doors of his castle and along a candle-lit corridor strewn with rushes. At the end of the corridor, the Count produced a brass key and unlocked a door.
"My private study," he said modestly. "I'm rather proud of my collection of books. I have almost 24.
"Formidable," Sophronia murmured.
"Perhaps you might care to read some of them, madam."
"The lady doesn't read," Sparhawk told him. "She's a Styric and an initiate in the secrets. She feels that reading might somehow interfere with her abilities."
"A witch," the Count said, looking at the small woman. "Truly."
"We prefer to use other terms, my lord," she replied mildly.
"Please, sit down," the Count said, pointing at a large table standing in a chill patch of wintry sunlight coming through a heavily barred window. "I'm curious to hear about this urgent matter."
Sparhawk removed his helmet and gauntlets and laid them on the table.
"Are you familiar with the name of Annius, Primate of Samira, my lord?" The Count's face hardened.
"I've heard of him," he said shortly.
"You know his reputation, then?"
"I do."
"Good. Quite by accident, Sir Kalthan and I unearthed a plot hatched by the Primate. Fortunately, he isn't aware of the fact that we know about it."
"Is your common practice so freely to admit church knights?"
"Of course. I revere the church and honor her knights."
Within a few days, a week at most, a sizable group of men in black armor and bearing the standards of Pandian knights will ride up to your gates. I strongly advise you not admit them."
"But..."
Sparhawk held up one hand. "They will not be Pandian, my lord. They're mercenaries under the command of a renegade named Martell. If you let them in, they will kill everyone within your walls, excepting only a churchman or two who will spread word of the outrage."
"Monstrous!" the Count gasped. "What reason could the Primate of Samira have to bear me such hatred?"
"The plot isn't directed at you, Count Radoon," Kalthan told him. "Your murder is designed to discredit the Pandian knights. Annius hopes that the bureaucracy of the church will be so infuriated that they'll disband the order."
"I must send word to Larium at once," the Count declared, coming to his feet. "My nephew can have an army here in a few days."
"That won't be necessary, my lord," Sparhawk said. "I have 500 fully armed Pandians, real ones,
concealed in the woods just to the north of your castle. With your permission, I'll bring 100 of them inside your walls to reinforce your garrison. When the mercenaries arrive, find some excuse not to admit them.
Won't that seem strange? Radun asked. I have a reputation for hospitality, for the Knights of the Church in particular.
The drawbridge, Calton said.
I beg your pardon.
Tell them that the windlass that operates your drawbridge is broken. Then tell them that you have men working on it and ask them to be patient.
I will not lie, the Count said stiffly.
That's all right, my lord, Calton assured him. I'll break the windlass for you myself, so you won't really be lying. The Count stared at him for a moment, then burst out laughing. The mercenaries will be outside the castle, Sparhawk went on, and your walls will give very little room for maneuvering. That's when we'll attack them from behind. Calton grinned broadly. It should be almost like a cheese grater when we start to grind them up against your walls.
And I can drop some interesting things on them from my battlements as well, the Count added, also grinning. Arrows, large rocks, burning pitch, that sort of thing.
We're going to get on splendidly, my lord, Calton told him.
I will, of course, make arrangements to lodge this lady and the little girl here in safety, the Count said.
No, my lord, Sophronia disagreed. I will accompany Sir Sparhawk and Sir Calton back to our hiding place. This Martell Sparhawk mentioned is a former Pandian, and he has delved deeply into secret knowledge that is forbidden to honest men. It may be necessary to counter him, and I'm best equipped to do that.
But surely the child...
The child must stay with me, Sophronia said firmly.
She looked over at Flute, who was in the act of curiously opening a book.
No,
she said, probably more sharply than she intended. She rose and took the book away from the little girl. Flute sighed, and Sophronia spoke briefly to her in that dialect Sparhawk did not understand. Since there was no way to know when Martell's mercenaries might arrive, the Pandians built no fires that night. And when the next morning dawned clear and cold, Sparhawk unrolled himself from his blankets and looked with some distaste at his armor, knowing that it would take at least an hour for the heat of his body to take the clammy chill out of it. He decided that he was not ready to face that just yet, so he belted on his sword, pulled his stout cloak around his shoulders, and walked down through the sleeping camp towards a small brook that trickled through the woods where he and his knights lay hidden. He knelt beside the brook and drank from his cupped hands, then braced himself and splashed icy water on his face. Then he rose, dried his face with the hem of his cloak, and stepped across the brook. The just-risen sun streamed golden into the leafless wood, slanting between the dark trunks and touching fire into the dewdrops collected like strings of beads along the stems of the grass about his feet. Sparhawk walked on through the woods. He had gone perhaps a half a mile when he saw a grassy meadow through the trees. As he approached the meadow, he heard the thudding of hooves. Somewhere ahead, a single horse was loping across the turf at a canter. And then he heard the sound of Flute's pipes rising in the morning air. He pushed his way to the edge of the meadow, parted the bushes, and peered out. Farron, his roan coat glistening in the morning sun, cantered easily in a wide, circular course around the meadow. He wore no saddle nor bridle, and there was something almost joyful about his stride. Flute lay face up on his back with her pipes at her lips. Her head was nestled comfortably on his surging front shoulders, her knees were crossed, and she was beating time on Farron's rump with one little foot. Sparhawk gaped at them, then stepped out into the meadow to stand directly in the big roan's path. He spread his arms wide, and Farron slowed to a walk and then stopped in front of his master.
What do you think you're doing?
Sparhawk barked at him. Farron's expression grew lofty, and he looked away.
Have you completely taken leave of your senses?
Farron snorted and flicked his tail, even as Flute continued to play her song. Then the little girl slapped her grass-stained foot imperiously on his rump several times, and he neatly sidestepped the fuming Sparhawk and cantered on with Flute's song soaring above him. Sparhawk swore and ran after them. After a few yards, he knew it was hopeless, and he stopped, breathing hard.
"Interesting, wouldn't you say?"
Sophronia said. She had come out from among the trees and stood at the edge of the meadow with her white robe gleaming in the morning sun. "Can you make them stop?" Sparhawk asked her. "She's going to fall off and get hurt."
"No, Sparhawk," Sophronia disagreed. "She will not fall."
She said it in that strange manner into which she sometimes lapsed. Despite the decades she had spent in a lean society, Sophronia remained a Styrix to her fingertips, and Styrix had always been an enigma to Aline's. The centuries of close association between the militant orders of the Aline Church and their Styrix tutors, however, had taught the church knights to accept the words of their instructors without question. "If you're sure," Sparhawk said a bit dubiously as he looked across the turf at Farron, who seemed somehow to have lost his normally vicious temperament.
"Yes, dear one," she said, laying an affectionate hand on his arm in reassurance. "I'm absolutely sure."
She looked out at the great horse and his tiny passenger, joyously circling the dew-drenched meadow in the golden morning sunlight.
"Let them play a while longer," she advised.
About mid-morning, Calton returned from the vantage point to the south of the castle, where he and Curic had been keeping watch over the road coming up from Serenium. "Nothing yet," he reported as he dismounted, his armor clinking. "Do you think Martell might just try to come across country and avoid the roads?"
"It's not very likely," Sparhawk replied. "He wants to be seen, remember? He needs lots of witnesses."
"I suppose I hadn't thought of that," Calton admitted. "Have you got the road coming down from Dara covered?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"Lacus and Barrett are watching it."
"Barrett?"
Calton sounded surprised. "The apprentice?
Isn't he a little young?"
"He'll get over it. He's steady, and he's got good sense. Besides, Lacus can keep him out of trouble."
"You're probably right.
Is there any of that roast ox the Count sent us left?"
"Help yourself. It isn't hot, though."
Calton shrugged. "Better cold meat than no meat." The day dragged on, as day spent only in waiting will do. By evening, Sparhawk was pacing the camp with his impatience gnawing at him. Finally, Sophronia emerged from the rough little tent she shared with Flute. She placed herself directly in front of the big knight in black armor, with her hands on her hips.
"Will you stop that?" she demanded crossly.
"Stop what?"
"Pacing. You jingle at every step, and the noise is very distracting."
"I'm sorry. I'll go jingle on the other side of camp."
"Why not just go and sit down?"
"Nerves, I guess."
"Nerves? You?"
"I get twinges now and then."
"Well, go twinge someplace else."
"Yes, little mother," he replied obediently.
It was cold again the following morning. Curic rode quietly into camp just before sunrise. He carefully picked his way past the sleeping knights, wrapped in their black cloaks, to the place where Sparhawk had spread his blankets.
"You'd better get up," he said, lightly touching Sparhawk's shoulder. "They're coming."
Sparhawk sat up quickly. "How many?" he asked, throwing off his blankets.
"I make it about 250.
Sparhawk stood up. "Where's Calton?" he asked, as Curic began to buckle the black armor over his lord's padded tunic.
"He wanted to make sure that there wouldn't be any surprises, so he joined the end of their column."
"He did what?"
"Don't worry, Sparhawk. They're all wearing black armor, so he blends right in."
"Do you want to tie this on?" Sparhawk handed his squire the length of bright ribbon that each knight was to wear as a means of identification during a battle in which both sides would be dressed in black. Curic took the red ribbon. Calton's wearing a blue one, he noted. It matches his eyes. He tied the ribbon around Sparhawk's upper arm, then stepped back and looked at his lord appraisingly. Adorable, he said, rolling his eyes. Sparhawk laughed and clapped his friend on the shoulder. Let's go wake the children, he said, looking across the encampment of generally youthful knights. I've got some bad news for you, Sparhawk, Curic said as the two of them moved out through the camp, shaking the sleeping Pandians awake. What's that? The man leading the column isn't Martell. Sparhawk felt a hot surge of disappointment. Who is it? He asked. Addis. He has blood all over his chin. I think he's been eating raw meat again. Sparhawk swore. Look at it this way. At least the world's going to be a cleaner place without Addis, and I'd imagine that God would like to have a long talk with him anyway. We'll have to see what we can do to arrange that. Sparhawk's knights were assisting each other into their armor when Calton rode into camp. They pulled up just beyond that hill to the south of the castle, he reported, not bothering to dismount. Is Martell possibly lurking around somewhere among them? Sparhawk asked hopefully. Calton shook his head. I'm afraid not. He stood up in his stirrups, shifting his sword around. Why don't we just go ahead and attack them? He suggested. I'm getting cold. I think Count Radun would be disappointed if we didn't let him take part in the fight. That's true, I suppose. Is there anything unusual about the mercenaries? Run of the mill, except that about half of them are Rendors. Rendors? They don't smell very good, do they? Sophrenia, accompanied by Parasim and Flute, came up to join them. Good morning, Sophrenia. Sparhawk greeted her.
Why all the bustle? She asked.
We have company coming. We thought we'd ride out to greet them.
Martell?
No, I'm afraid it's only Addis and a few friends. He shifted the helmet he was holding under his left arm. Since Martell isn't leading them, and since Addis can barely speak Elenic, much less Styric, there isn't anybody out there who could stir up enough magic to knock a fly off the wall. I'm afraid that means that you've made the trip for nothing. I want you to stay back here in the woods, well hidden and out of danger. Sir Parasim will stay with you. The young knight's face filled with disappointment.
No, Sparhawk, Sophrenia replied. I need no guard, and this is Parasim's first battle. We won't deprive him of it.
Parasim's face shone with gratitude. Kira came back through the woods from the place where he had been keeping watch. The sun's coming up, he reported, and Addis is leading his men over the top of that hill. We'd better mount up then, Sparhawk said. The Pandians swung up into their saddles and moved cautiously through the wood until they reached the edge of the broad meadow that surrounded the Count's castle. Then they waited, watching the black-armored mercenaries riding down the hill in the golden dawn sunlight. Addis, who normally spoke in grunts and belches, rode up to the gate of Count Radun's castle and read haltingly from a piece of paper, which he held in front of him at arm's length.
Can't he extemporize? Calton asked quietly. He's only asking for permission to enter the castle.
Martell doesn't take chances, Sparhawk replied. And Addis usually has trouble remembering his own name. Addis continued to read his request. He had some trouble with the word admission, since it had more than one syllable. Then Count Radun appeared on the battlements to announce regretfully that the windlass which raised and lowered the drawbridge was broken, and to beg them to be patient until it was repaired. Addis mulled that over. It took him quite a while. The mercenaries dismounted and lounged about on the grass at the foot of the castle wall.
This is going to be almost too easy, Calton muttered.
Let's just make sure that none of them get away, Sparhawk told him.
I don't want anybody writing to Annius with word of what has really happened today. I still think Vanyan's trying to be too clever about this. Maybe that's why he's the preceptor, and we're only knights. A red banner appeared atop the Count's walls. There's the signal, Sparhawk said. Radun's forces are ready. He put on his helmet, gathered his reins, and rose in his stirrups, firmly holding Farron in. Then he raised his voice. Charge! He roared. Chapter 9. Any chance at all? Calton asked. No, Sparhawk replied with deep regret as he lowered Sir Parasim to the ground. He's gone. He smoothed the young knight's hair with his hand, then gently closed the vacant eyes. He wasn't ready to come up against Addis, Calton said. Did that animal get completely away? I'm afraid so. After he cut down Parasim, he rode off to the south with about a dozen other survivors. Send some people after him, Sparhawk said bleakly, as he straightened the fallen Sir Parasim's limbs. Tell them to run him into the sea, if necessary. Do you want me to do it? No. You and I have to go to Krullos. He raised his voice then. Barret! He shouted. The novice approached at a half-run. He was wearing an old mail shirt splashed with blood and a dented foot soldier's helmet with no visor. He carried a grim, long-handled battle axe. Sparhawk looked closely at the blood on the rangy youth's mail shirt. Is any of that yours? He asked.
No, my lord,
Barret answered. All theirs. He looked pointedly at the mercenary dead, littering the field. Good. What's your feeling about a long ride?
As my lord commands.
He's got good manners, at least, Calton observed. Barret, he said then, ask where before you agree so quickly.
I'll remember that, my lord Calton.
I want you to come with me, Sparhawk said to the novice. We need to talk with Count Radun before you leave. He turned to Calton. Get a group of men to chase Addis, he said. Push him hard. I don't want him to have time to send one of his people to Samura to report all of this to Annius. Tell the rest of the men to bury our dead and care for the wounded. Well, what about these? Calton pointed at the dead bodies of the mercenaries heaped in front of the castle walls. Burn them. Count Radun met Sparhawk and Barret in the courtyard of his castle. He was wearing full armor and held his sword in his hand.
I see that the reputation of the Pandians is well deserved, he said.
Thank you, my lord, Sparhawk replied. I have a favor. No, two favors to ask of you.
Anything, Sir Sparhawk.
Are you known to any members of the aristocracy in Krellos?
Several, actually, and the Patriarch of Larium is a distant cousin of mine.
Very good. I know it's a bad season for travel, but I'd like you to join me in a little ride.
Of course. Where are we going?
To Krellos. The next favor is a bit more personal. I'll need your signet ring.
My ring?
The Count lifted his hand and looked at the heavy gold ring bearing his coat of arms. Sparhawk nodded. And worse yet, I can't guarantee that I'll be able to return it.
I'm not sure that I understand.
Barret here is going to take the ring to Samura and drop it in the collection plate during service in the cathedral there. The primate Annius will take that to mean that his scheme has succeeded and that you and your family have all been murdered. He will then rush to Krellos to lay charges against the Pandians before the aristocracy. Count Radun grinned broadly.
But then you and I will step forward and refute those charges, right?
Sparhawk grinned back.
Exactly, he said. That might cause the primate a certain amount of embarrassment, the Count said as he tugged the ring off his finger.
That was sort of what we had in mind, my lord.
The ring is well lost, then, Radun said, handing his signet to Barret.
All right, Sparhawk said to the young novice. Don't kill any horses on your way to Samura. Give us time to get to Krellos before Annius does. He squinted thoughtfully.
Morning service, I think.
My lord?
Drop the Count's ring in the collection plate during morning service. Let's give Annius a whole day to gloat before he starts out for Krellos. Wear ordinary clothes when you go into the cathedral and pray a bit, just to make it look convincing. Don't go near the chapter house or the inn on Rose Street. He looked at the young novice, feeling a renewed pang at the loss of Sir Parasim. I can't assure you that your life won't be in danger, Barrett, he said soberly, so I can't order you to do this.
There's no need to order me to do it, my Lord Sparhawk,
Barrett replied. Good man, Sparhawk said. Now go and get your horse. You've got a long ride ahead of you. It was nearly noon when Sparhawk and Count Radun emerged from the castle.
How long do you think it's going to take for Primate Annius to reach Krellos? The Count asked.
2 weeks at least. Barrett has to get to Samira before Annius can even start for Krellos. Kira came riding up to them.
Everything's ready, he told Sparhawk.
Sparhawk nodded. You'd better go and get Sophronia, he said.
Is that really a good idea, Sparhawk? Things might get a little chancy when we get to Krellos. Do you want to be the one to tell her that she has to stay behind?
Kyrick winced.
I see what you mean, he said. Where's Calton?
Over there at the edge of the woods. He's building a bonfire for some reason.
Maybe he's cold.
The winter sun was very bright in the cold blue sky as Sparhawk and his party set out.
Surely, madame, Count Radun objected to Sophronia. The child would have been quite safe within the walls of my castle.
She would not have stayed there, my lord,
Sophronia replied in a small voice. She laid her cheek against Flute's hair.
Besides, she added, I take great comfort in having her with me.
Her voice sounded weak somehow, and she looked very pale and tired. In one hand she carried Sir Parasim's sword. Sparhawk pulled Farinin beside her white palfrey.
Are you all right? He asked her quietly. Not really, she answered.
What's the matter? He felt a sudden alarm.
Parasim was one of the 12 knights in the throne room in Samira, she sighed. I've just been obliged to shoulder his burden, as well as my own.
She gestured slightly with the sword. You're not ill, are you?
Not in the way that you mean, no. It's just that it's going to take a little while to adjust to the additional weight.
Is there any way that I could carry it for you?
No, dear one.
He drew in a deep breath. Sophronia, he said. Is what happened to Parasim today a part of what you told me was going to happen to the 12 knights?
There's no way to know, Sparhawk. The compact we made with the younger gods was not that specific.
She smiled wanly.
If another of the knights dies this moon, though, we'll know that it was merely an accident and had nothing to do with the compact.
We're going to lose them one every month?
Moon, she corrected. 28 days. Most probably, yes. The younger gods tend to be methodical about such things. Don't concern yourself about me, Sparhawk. I'll be all right in a little while.
It was some 60 leagues from the Count's castle to the city of Dara, and on the morning of the 4th day of their journey, they crested a hill and looked down upon the red tile roofs and the hundreds of chimneys sending pale blue columns of smoke straight up into the windless air. A black-armored Pandian knight awaited them on the hilltop.
Sir Sparhawk,
the knight said, raising his visor.
Sir Olvin, Sparhawk replied, recognizing the knight's scarred face.
I've a message for you from Preceptor Vanyan. He instructs you to proceed directly to Samira with all possible speed.
Samira? Why the change in plans?
King Dragos is there, and he's invited Wargun of Talicia and Obler of Dera to join him. He wants to investigate the illness of Queen Elana and the justification for the appointment of the bastard Lycius as Prince Regent. Vanyan believes that Annius will level his charges against our order at that council in order to deflect an inquiry that might be embarrassing.
Sparhawk swore. Barrett's a good way ahead of us by now, he said. Have all the kings gathered in Samira yet? Olvin shook his head.
King Obler is too old to travel very fast, and it's likely to take a week to sober King Worgen up before he can make the voyage from Amsat.
Let's not gamble on that, Sparhawk said. We'll cut across country to Deimos and then ride directly to Samira. Is Vanyan still at Krellos?
No, he came through Deimos on his way to Samira. The patriarch Dolmont was with him.
Dolmont, Calton said.
That's a surprise. Who's running the church?
Sir Calton,
Count Radun said stiffly,
the guidance of the church is in the hands of the archprelate.
Sorry, my lord, Calton apologized. I know how much Arcians revere the church, but let's be honest. Archprelate Cluvonius is 85 years old, and he sleeps a great deal. Dolmont doesn't make an issue of it, but most of the decisions that come out of Krellos are his.
Let's ride, Sparhawk said. It took them 4 days of hard traveling to reach Deimos, where Sir Olvin left them to return to the Pandian motherhouse, and it was 3 more days before they arrived at the gates of the chapter house in Samira.
Do you know where we can find Lord Vanyan? Sparhawk asked the novice, who came out into the courtyard to take their horses.
He's in his study in the South Tower, my lord, with the Patriarch Dolmont.
Sparhawk nodded and led the way inside and up the narrow stairs.
Thank God you arrived in time, Vanyan greeted them.
Has Barrett delivered the Count's ring yet? Sparhawk asked him.
Vanyan nodded. 2 days ago, I had men inside the cathedral watching.
He frowned slightly.
Was it altogether wise to entrust that kind of mission to a novice, Sparhawk?
Barrett's a solid young man, Sparhawk explained, and he isn't widely known here in Samira. Most of the full-fledged knights are.
I see. It was your command, Sparhawk. The decision was yours. How did things go in Arcium?
Addis led the mercenaries, Calton replied. We didn't see a sign of Martell. Otherwise, things went more or less as planned. Addis got away, though.
Sparhawk drew in a deep breath. We lost Parasim, he said sadly. I'm sorry, Vanyan. I tried to keep him out of the fight.
Vanyan's eyes clouded with sudden grief.
I know, Sparhawk said, touching the older man's shoulder. I loved him, too.
He saw the quick look that passed between Vanyan and Sophrenia. She nodded slightly, as if to advise the preceptor that Sparhawk knew that Parasim had been one of the 12. Then Sparhawk straightened and introduced Count Radun and Vanyan to each other.
I owe you my life, Lord Vanyan, Radun said as they shook hands. Please tell me how I can repay you.
Your presence here in Samira is ample repayment, my lord.
Have the other kings joined my nephew as yet? The count asked.
Obler has, Vanyan replied. King Worgen is still at sea, though.
A thin man, dressed in a severe black cassock, sat near the window. He appeared to be in his late 50s and had silvery hair. His face was ascetic and his eyes were very keen. Sparhawk crossed the room and knelt respectfully before him.
Your Grace, he greeted the Patriarch of Deimos.
You're looking well, Sir Sparhawk, the churchman told him. It's good to see you again.
Then he looked over Sparhawk's shoulder.
Have you been going to chapel, Curic? He asked the squire.
Whenever there's opportunity, Your Grace, Curic answered, flushing slightly.
Excellent, my son, Dolmont said. I'm sure that God is always glad to see you. How are Aslaid and the boys?
Well, Your Grace, thank you for asking.
Sophrenia had been looking critically at the Patriarch.
You haven't been eating properly, Dolmont, she told him.
Oh, sometimes I forget, he said.
Then he smiled slyly at her.
My overwhelming concern with the conversation of the heathen fills all my waking thoughts. Tell me, Sophrenia, are you ready at last to put aside your pagan ways and embrace the true faith?
Not yet, Dolmont, she replied, also smiling. It was nice of you to ask, though.
He laughed.
I thought I'd get the question out of the way early, so we can converse without having it hanging over our heads.
He looked curiously at Flute,
who is walking about the room, examining the furnishings.
"And who is this beautiful child?"
he asked. "She's a foundling, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied. "We came across her near the Arcian border. She doesn't talk, so we call her Flute." Dolmont looked at the little girl's grass-stained